and you look at what's going on in Chicago, what the hell is going on in Chicago? What the hell is happening there?
That's President Trump speaking to the FBI last year about a rise in violent crime in the city of Chicago. Thanks to ABC 7 for that audio. But new reporting suggests we shouldn't be looking at the murder rates and that shootings represent a much more accurate picture of violence. And for the first time, women can order tests for genetic mutations that increase the risk for breast cancer without having to see a doctor. But what's more convenient for customers may not be better for patients. Plus, grad students might be much more likely to experience depression. Here's University of Kentucky professor Nathan Vanderford speaking to the Sigma Xi Society.
For me, it was everything from your experiment that day didn't work, and you know it might have been several weeks worth of working up to the point of trying to get data for this experiment, and then it ended up not working.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started just after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to how Chicago is portrayed in the media and even by our president, it's often not a pretty picture. And that's because for the most part, the emphasis has been placed on the city's murder statistics. But according to a new report published in City Lab, this narrative of Chicago being a murder capital is not a complete one. First, you don't get the accurate picture of just how many people are being saved because Chicago has one of the world's best ER networks and trauma care systems in the world. And second, because of those trauma care achievements, the true scale of gun violence hasn't really come to light. There are hundreds of individuals shot every year who survive, and those are statistics the news media and the Chicago Police Department rarely talk about. Joining me now are Eric Furkenhoff and Darnell Little, who reported on this for City Lab. Eric is a journalist and professor based in Chapel Hill. Darnell is the editor of the Data Reporting Lab. Eric, Darnell, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Eric, let me start by asking, before we start this conversation, I think it is important to put Chicago's murder rate in context, because Chicago does get a lot of attention for how many gun violence murders happen here. Before we even get into all of this, can you maybe frame that in context for everybody who's listening, how Chicago compares to, say, a city like Baltimore?
Well, Baltimore per capita has a higher murder rate than Chicago. We have a higher volume. And a lot of people mistake that and think that the volume is what counts, but the per capita rate is actually a more accurate rate because it's telling you the number of people being killed per the number of people living in a particular place. So what the chances are of being shot and wounded or killed is actually lower in Chicago than it would be in places like New York, L.A., Baltimore, other big cities.
All right. So that's the in context, I think, just an important point to note before we get into the details of this. Darnell, you and Eric began your story by talking about 4th of July in Chicago. Crime reporters know this is a very busy time. Paramedics, police officers, firefighters know to expect this as a violent weekend. And I think at this point, the public does as well. Can we go back to this past 4th of July in 2017? What happened that weekend in Chicago?
Well, it was 4th of July, fell on a Tuesday. So it was an exceptionally long holiday weekend, which typically spells trouble, because you know we have come to expect that kind of spike in violence over the 4th of July weekend, and last year with the extra long weekend, it running to, depending on how you want to measure it, 5 days, it didn't look like it was going to be very pretty, and it wasn't. Once again, depending on where you start counting the weekend and where you stop, you know, we had from 80 to 100 people shot that weekend. But just a small percentage of them actually died. But that was, unfortunately, rather typical for Chicago over its 4th of July weekend. There's just a, unfortunately, bloody sort of history with that.
Right. And we can get into that. And we've had lots of conversations in the past, both on the 21st and in media reporting about violence that spikes in the summer. But 80 to 100 people shot over one weekend, whether that's you're counting 3 days or 4 days. There were so many people who were saved that weekend, as you pointed out, 15 people, unfortunately, who died. I want to talk about that in a minute. But Darnell, when you look at the big picture of not just that weekend in 2017, but over the past few years, do we have good data on shootings in the city?
It's gotten better. You can FOIA the Center for Freedom of Information Act to the Chicago Police Department and get shooting data going back to 2010, but nothing before that. And there still are some problems with how the police record shootings versus how, let's say, media outlets record shootings. They don't record the number of shooting victims. They record the number of shooting incidents. So if four or five people were shot in one particular shooting incident, that counts as just one shooting incident. Whereas, let's say, the media like the Chicago Tribune or the Sun-Times, which keep their own shooting data, they count the number of shooting victims. So it's not perfect, but they have made an effort in recent years to publish some form of shooting data so we can get a better idea of it. Before the past few years, you didn't even get that. You just got the homicide data, and that was it. Now it's starting to become more routine that toward the end of the year, when they give the homicide roundup, they will also give the number of shooting incidents for the year.
Eric, why aren't these numbers that the Chicago Police Department talk about as much compared to, say, homicide figures?
Well, a lot of it goes back to just how the numbers are presented. They're usually presented in a very sterile environment during a news conference where the police hold it at police headquarters, which is a very walled-off complex, et cetera, and getting any information out of there is not like getting information out of the old police headquarters at 11th and State, where you could roam the halls and perhaps run into the chief of detectives or the superintendent and get a real picture. So they don't hold these news conferences in companion with the fire department or with trauma surgeons or anything like that. They hold it just by themselves. And obviously there's a lot of public relations that falls into the presenting of data, and you want to present it in the best light possible, as sad as the narrative may be. And so they, a lot of times, will show ups or downs and where strategies or police tactics are coming into play to either lower those numbers, et cetera.
Hmm. We're speaking with, that's Eric Virkenhoff. He's a journalist with City Lab. Darnell Little is also with us. He's editor of the Data Reporting Lab. I wanted to bring someone in who's seen into this conversation, who's experienced this firsthand. Dr. Farhan Bakari is chair of the Trauma and Burn Surgery Unit for Cook County Health and Hospital Systems. Dr. Bakari, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
As we've been discussing, Dr. Bakari, I think it's pretty well known there's lots of victims of gun violence in Chicago. There's many gun-related deaths every year, but I don't think it's as well known how many more people are shot and survive due to doctors like in your unit. So when we were talking about 4th of July weekend last year, 15 people died, but depending on the numbers, anywhere from 85 or around that were also survived. Can you describe what it's like at trauma centers like the ones that you work in when shootings happen, the kind of work that happens to help make sure that people survive?
Sure. This is unfortunate, but, you know, we've been dealing with a lot of the gun violence in Chicago over the past 50 years, which is when the trauma center was formed. We probably have one of the highest experiences with gunshot wounds and injuries in the country. So we've seen ebb and flow of these shootings, and we've been fortunate or unfortunate enough to deal with these victims, and we've been able to develop our protocols, both the nursing protocols and the paramedic protocols and the surgeon and doctor protocols and intensive care protocols to fine-tune them intervene at critical points in the management of the patient to give them a better chance at survival. And these protocols have evolved over the last 50 years. And we've sort of been at the lead of this, these types of protocols, for the better part of 5 decades now.
And Dr. Bakari, as I learned reading Darnell and Eric's story, you have Army and Navy medics who actually train in Chicago alongside Chicago trauma doctors because it's good preparation, unfortunately, for combat experience. Is that accurate?
Yes. We have Navy personnel that come to us pre-deployment, and we also have special forces that rotate through us. These are medics and physicians and nurses that will come to us, and then you just have to place them in the right environment, which is a lot of penetrating trauma coming in, and then you're able to teach them how to best help the patients here or on the battlefield.
Eric, as Dr. Bakari is talking about physicians, you all reported that this sophisticated knowledge base goes beyond physicians, and you quoted a firefighter who didn't want to be named saying everyone knows it's the fire department that saves lives in Chicago, not the police. Can I ask mm-hmm. you about that and also about the geographic limitations to paramedics, and if they're far away from level one trauma centers, what role location plays in life-saving, Eric?
Yes, on the quote, that was an official who didn't want to be named, I think for quite obvious reasons. They need to maintain a relationship with the police department and work in tandem with them. But it happened to be the first quote that came out of the reporting of the story when we first reached the fire department. That was the very first words out of the official's mouth. I think it's kind of reflective of finally someone's telling this side of the story. As for the geographic limitations, I mean, if you're living on the north side of Chicago or some parts of the south side or west side of Chicago, there's, when going back to the murder per capita, I mean, it goes down dramatically, but there's certain sections of the south and west sides that are these battlefields that the doctor talked about, et cetera. So basically, I think that we showed that 94%, or Darnell showed that 94% of all the shootings and homicide victims from particular years are based on the, are located on the south and west sides of Chicago.
And Dr. Bakari, when Chicago has 6 level one trauma centers, I wonder what a difference it makes in terms of how many miles away someone is in terms of their chances of survival, how far they are away from a level one trauma center. Dr. Bakari?
Sure. So that's a pretty controversial topic, as you might imagine. In trauma, there was in the definition of the golden hour like 4 decades ago. We've found that that there's a critical 1 hour in which time, you could make a difference in the patient's prognosis. And that's sort of very controversial because it's not held up in all circumstances. As you might imagine, it's less than an hour to any trauma center within Chicago. The utility of that 1 hour has been questioned on top of that you might have, in the sense that you might have more time than an hour. And in people that are critical enough, it doesn't really matter how fast you get them someplace. So this is and back and forth, and the literature and the data is very, very unclear on that. What we are beginning to find out, though, is that trauma centers are possibly, this is our thought here and some of our investigation, the trauma centers are no different from other specialty centers. And what we are beginning to sort of just study this is that a trauma center is not just a trauma center, it's not just a trauma center. Meaning, it used to be thought that if you went to a place that does cancer surgery, that all types of cancers would be treated well there. What's been found out is that if you do a lot of pancreatic cancer surgery, the doctors get really good at that. And I think that that might be sort of true in trauma centers as well. So there's blunt trauma like car crashes, and there's geriatric trauma, as in older patients who might be on blood thinners who fall down. And then there's penetrating trauma such as gunshot wounds. Now, those are very distinct entities. They might not be exactly the same. So our thought is that perhaps it's less the golden hour, the average time to any level one center in the Chicago area being less than 20 minutes, but it's more the expertise of the physicians and what they've been exposed to that might foretell the prognosis better. So, for instance,
and Dr. Bakari, can I just stop you just because we just have about a minute left, and I just want to ask you very quickly. Also, when you're talking about gun trauma, are you seeing also making a difference with different types of guns, as we've seen in the news now? Does that also further complicate things?
It does, but the vast majority of gun injuries are from handguns. The high-powered rifles that are very prominent in mass shootings are not as common in these street incidents that we talk about.
There's lots more information in the reporting that was done by Eric Firkenhoff and Darnell Little. We'll tweet all of that out for those of you who'd like to read more. If you want to follow us, our handle's 21stshow. We'll have it up at 21stshow.org. But I want to thank Eric and Darnell for joining me, as well as Dr. Farhan Bakari, Chair of Trauma and Burn Surgery with Cook County Health and Hospital Systems. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Anyone with a family history of breast cancer has probably wondered, do I carry the gene that makes me more at risk for the disease? It's a concern that's been heightened in recent years by an increased awareness of public figures like Angelina Jolie, who, being carriers of a gene that's linked with breast cancer, opted to get a preventative mastectomy. Until now, the only way to find out about your genetic risks when it comes to cancer was to see a doctor and ask him or her to order tests. But the Food and Drug Administration has just approved the first test that Americans can get without a doctor. And the company 23andMe is offering a testing kit direct to consumer for three specific mutations that increase one's risk for breast cancer. Shirley Wu is the company's director of product science. She's on the line with us now from Mountain View, California. Shirley, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Shirley, how does this work? What does someone want to do if they would like to test their genes or their genetic history in terms of being a risk for breast cancer?
It's a very simple process. So a consumer can just go online and buy a kit, and the kit arrives at your home, and you send back a saliva sample, and in a few weeks you receive your results in a secure online account.
And what is the results? What do the results say?
So our product includes many results, but for this particular test for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 selected variants report, a consumer would receive a report about these three specific genetic variants, and the report would tell them whether they have one of these variants. If they don't have one of these variants, it does not mean that someone is free of risk from breast cancer or ovarian cancer, since these are just three variants out of many thousands in this gene. And there are many other genes and other factors that also contribute to cancer. But if someone does have one of these variants, it is incredibly meaningful. The risks for breast cancer go up to 85% by the age of 70, and for ovarian cancer around up to 40%. And for men, there's also a risk. So their risk of breast cancer is also increased. So this information is incredibly useful to know And individuals can work with their doctors to understand what next steps might be appropriate for them, including getting that result confirmed before taking any medical action.
And how does that work when they get the results? Is there help for people to interpret them? Is that service? Do you provide services for that as well?
So before someone actually sees their results, we actually require people to read some additional information and decide for themselves whether they would actually like to receive that information. We understand that receiving information about risk for cancer can raise a lot of questions, and some people would prefer not to know. So we actually do require people to choose specifically if they would like to receive it or not. And if they do, then before they see the report, we also ask them to view an educational module. So this is just a short set of slides that contain information that just help them understand more about what this report can and can't tell them, what the potential risks are, and all the different factors that go into whether someone develops cancer, as well as what to do with those results afterwards. So the report itself provides, again, a lot of that information and points them to resources such as genetic counseling and support groups for additional help.
And Shirley, I mentioned the FDA just approved this. What kind of response have you all gotten at 23andMe for people who are requesting testing for these specific mutations of the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes?
The response has been really, really promising and heartening. Obviously, there are people that have concerns about the test because it does cover just these three variants. But these three variants are the most well-studied variants in these genes. So they are scientifically very well-established, and there's great understanding about what they mean in terms of risks for cancer. And so we've seen a ton of interest in the test. People are very interested to find out more, and our customers have been very interested in getting information about this for a long time. So we're very excited to be able to provide access to this information now.
From 23andMe's perspective, what limitations do you think consumers should be aware of when they're using your services?
A big thing to be aware of is, again, the fact that this test does currently cover just these three variants. There are thousands of other variants in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes that have been linked to risk for cancer. These three variants are three of the most common and the three most well-studied variants. In particular, in people of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, about 1 in 40 people has one of these three variants. And so these three variants are incredibly important for people with that ancestry. And these variants represent about 90% of the hereditary breast and ovarian cancer variants in that population. So it has incredible significance for that population and then for anyone else who happens to have one of these variants.
That's Shirley Wu. She's Director of Product Science at 23andMe, which is making these direct-to-consumer kits available, as we've been discussing, for three specific mutations of the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes that are associated with breast cancer, ovarian cancer, also with prostate cancer. Shirley, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As many of you listening know, I have firsthand experience with all of this because I was diagnosed with breast cancer last year. If you haven't heard, all of my treatment is finished. I'm doing great. That's thanks in part to our next guest, Dr. Nora Hansen, who's the chief of breast surgery at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, where she also teaches. And she was my surgeon. During the course of this, I also had to have genetic testing, and that's where I also met Carmen Williams. She's a genetic counselor at Northwestern Medicine. Dr. Hansen, Carmen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Sam.
Dr. Hansen, let me start with you. Are you starting to encounter patients who are coming to you because they've gotten testing on their own? Or patients, I don't know how often you've seen patients who've come to you just because they are concerned about their genetic history.
So I see more patients that come with a concern about their genetic history, not that they've had testing yet. I have not seen a lot of I haven't seen any patients who've showed up yet with this 23andMe testing. We have seen patients who come in from testing from their gynecologist for, like, the MyRisk panel, which gives you a large number of different mutations. But most of the people will come to see us who are concerned about their family history or have just been diagnosed with cancer at a young age, and we would recommend genetic testing.
Carmen, as we just heard from the director of product science at 23andMe, I wanted to start with the science. She mentioned the two, that testing looks at three specific mutations of the genes. When we're talking about testing that Dr. Hansen was mentioning, that's a little bit different, right? It sounds like it's a little bit more extensive testing that looks at different genes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So this is the 23andMe test that they are mentioning in the BRCA genes is looking just at three specific variants in those two genes. The test that Dr. Hansen's referring to and the testing that we typically order will actually include thousands of variants that are evaluated in sometimes dozens of genes. And so it's a far more comprehensive test.
And what does the genetic counselor do? What is your job, Carmen?
Yeah, my job is really to make sure that when I am sitting down with someone, I am looking at their entire family history. We'll usually look at an entire three-generation pedigree, which is just a family tree, showing us all the cancers that have happened in someone's family. We're going to evaluate that and really assess whether there's a high risk for a genetic mutation or whether there's a low risk. And then when it's indicated, we'll offer testing to patients to help them figure out what, if any, genetic mutations there might be. Once we get those results, we will make sure to sit down with patients and talk through the result, however it comes out, whether it's a positive result with a mutation or whether it's a normal negative test result, and make sure that they understand then, based on that result, what their cancer risks are, because even people with normal results have cancer risks, and make sure they're getting the appropriate follow-up.
Carmen, is it concerning to you to hear that people might get these results on their own? And it sounds like Shirley was explaining with 23andMe that there's a video that people can watch or there's maybe some information online. How do you feel about that?
I think that it's concerning to a lot of us in the genetics community. There's, of course, a little bit of concern that someone would come across a BRCA mutation having not really understood what they were actually getting tested for. But it sounds like 23andMe is trying to make sure that they minimize that by providing education ahead of time. However, one of our bigger concerns is actually those who wouldn't fully understand the test get a normal test result from this saying they don't have any of those specific three mutations, and then would just assume that they don't have any mutations at all.
And the case, and as you're saying, there's thousands of other possibilities that could also genetically have someone put at risk for this. That's what you mean.
Yeah, absolutely. There are thousands of other mutations. And I think also very importantly, these three mutations are really only informative in people of Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. So the chance of finding this in anyone else is anywhere from 0 to 0.1% chance, meaning that someone without Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, this test is somewhat meaningless.
Dr. Hansen, from a medical standpoint, as a surgeon, what would you like people to know who are doing these tests?
Well, I mean, I think it's very important to understand the implications of both a positive and negative test. And I do think it's very hard for a patient just to look at a short video or a few slides to really comprehend what the impact of the genetic testing is. I did hear that your first guest was saying that it should be repeated before any treatment is done, which seems a little, you know, now the patient's going to have to pay twice for a similar, you know, outcome for that one, those three specific areas. But I just don't think that patients can quite comprehend just from a short video really the impact of what the testing is. And I agree with Carmen that the false sense of security that a negative test would give a patient, I think, is misdirect. It's just not, it shouldn't be considered a test that's just negative.
Right, because
I think it still have a higher risk.
Right, so people could, a higher risk for other things. Dr. Hansen, when a woman or man is aware that he or she is a carrier, what next steps do you normally advise them to do, to take from there?
So it's a little bit different for men and women because even though men do have an increased risk, it's still not that high. But we would still recommend for men, breast exams. There's a little controversy about whether or not they should be getting mammograms yearly, and I don't think we offer yearly mammograms to men who are BRCA positive. We do not perform prophylactic mastectomies in men if they're BRCA positive, as we would offer a prophylactic mastectomy for women who were BRCA positive, because I think the men's risk is still relatively low. So usually if someone comes to see me and they have the gene, we'll talk about two options. One would be either close surveillance, and close surveillance would mean breast exams twice a year as well as increased imaging. So we'd offer mammograms once a year and MRIs once a year because these patients tend to have a higher rate of interval cancers or cancers in between your mammograms. So we recommend increased screening. And then the other option would be the prophylactic surgery. And not everyone picks prophylactic surgery. I mean, it's a very individual decision, and it's a discussion that we have with each individual patient. And, sometimes a patient will start with increased screening for a while and then get tired of the screening or the false negatives and or false positives, and then they elect to go with the surgery.
Carmen, Dr. Hansen's been talking about steps for also with the BRCA gene, the 1 and 2 mutations. What other genetic mutations are genetic counselors, genetic testing also looking for? I think people always hear about BRCA, BRCA, but there are other genes. What are other genes people should be thinking about or becoming aware of?
Yeah, one of the big ones is actually Lynch syndrome, which is named after Dr. Henry Lynch, who discovered it. There are 5 different genes that we find in patients with Lynch syndrome having mutations. And Lynch syndrome increases the risk of colon cancer up to around a 60 to 70% risk lifetime for both men and women. So for those patients, we need to do a lot more colonoscopies, and we need to start at younger ages. There are other cancer risks with Lynch syndrome, such as uterine cancer, and in some families, things like stomach cancer. So that's another syndrome that is present in the population as commonly as the BRCA genes, and one that we try to keep an eye out for very carefully. And then there are a number of other syndromes a little bit more rare that can lead to breast cancer, such as Cowden syndrome, Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, and hereditary diffuse gastric cancer syndrome. So those are all things that we're evaluating when we look at a family history.
And when you're also looking, you look for mutations for breast cancer as well, other genetic mutations, like I believe, is it PALB2? Is that another gene that you've recently
PALB2 is another gene that can cause high risks for breast cancer. And then there are some other genes that we're still working on defining the best way to care for patients with these, but ATM and CHEK2 are 2 other genes that have a lower impact on breast cancer risk, maybe causing around a 20 to 25% lifetime risk for breast cancer.
So both of you, we just have about a minute or two left, but I just wanted to ask you one last question as for both of you as medical folks in the medical field. Dr. Hansen, let's start with you. What advice do you have for people as they're starting, as these kits are becoming more popular, more people are doing genetic testing? What advice would you have as to how they approach this? Dr. Hansen?
So I would say, if you're interested in doing it, you should also speak with your, primary care physician and just let them know that you're doing this so that you can have support as well. And I think if you're very worried about your family history, that, it is important that you meet with a genetic counselor to go over it. I think a lot of people overestimate their risk of breast cancer risk and are often fearful. And when they meet with a genetic counselor or with us, they often find that their risk is really not as high as they think. So I just think it's caution when you do tests like this, and education is the most important thing that they can do for themselves.
Thanks for that. That's Dr. Nora Hansen. She's chief of breast surgery at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. Carmen Williams is also a licensed genetic counselor who works in cancer genetics at Northwestern. Dr. Hansen, Carmen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Graduate students have a lot on their plate. They're usually taking and teaching classes in addition to writing dissertations that can usually take years to finish. They don't make much money. We heard about that when graduate students at the University of Illinois went on strike. It lasted 2 weeks. It ended last week. That's been resolved, by the way, with higher pay and tuition waivers. That's a big stress reliever, no doubt. But perhaps it's no surprise that a recent study released by Nature Biotechnology says that graduate students are 6 times as likely to experience depression and anxiety when compared with the general population. And that study warns of a crisis in graduate education. We're joined now by two of the lead authors of that study, Nathan Vanderford and Teresa Evans. Nathan is an assistant professor at the College of Medicine at the University of Kentucky. Teresa is an assistant professor at University of Texas's Health Science Center in Antonio. Nathan, Teresa, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Nathan, being a PhD student is actually, I think, a pretty unique experience. So I think we have lots of people listening who haven't experienced that. I wonder, or they're removed from it. It was something that maybe happened for them a long time ago. I wonder if you could describe some of the common themes in day-to-day life of a modern graduate student and being a PhD student in particular.
Yeah, this is Teresa. I'm happy to take that one. As I graduated my PhD in 2014 from the Health Science Center in San Antonio. And so from my experiences pursuing a degree, and I should also qualify that that's in the life sciences, I pursued a degree in neuroscience. And, the process is unique in that it's one of the last environments where you're truly an apprentice and you're working not only under your laboratory supervisor and mentor, but also under the mentorship of all of the faculty at your university. And for that reason, as you're going through the process of completing your dissertation, you're often struggling to, find your place at the table. And I think that's what makes it a really unique situation and a unique environment.
Nathan, I wonder if you want to add in as well any other unique experiences people should be thinking about or common themes for modern graduate students?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first couple years of graduate school is really focused on heavy coursework, and a lot of times, particularly in the life sciences, as Teresa and I are both most familiar with, you're doing coursework, but you're also trying to find a lab and a mentor in which you'll do your research for your dissertation project. That can be a very stressful time, trying to find a good mentor and a lab that you can work in. And then the last several years of grad school is much less unstructured, and you're really running at your own pace in many regards and trying to get your research project done and publish some papers and contribute it to the literature and eventually earn your PhD.
Teresa, we should say again in your study, when we say graduate students, you mostly studied PhD students, correct?
So our study includes individuals who also have master's degrees, but the majority of the respondents are PhD students.
And in that, you found that 39% of the people that you surveyed scored in the moderate to severe depression range. How would you define moderate to severe depression, Teresa?
So based on the assessments that we used, we can really only say that these individuals had symptoms associated with, what clinically we would call moderate to severe depression. It's important to note that this is a survey, not a clinical setting where we evaluated these individuals, face-to-face. And so the definition that I can give you is really only that they're indicating that they're expressing symptoms associated with what clinically we would call depression in a moderate to severe level.
And what kind of symptoms are those, Teresa?
Yeah, so symptoms such as that we asked them to self-report if they'd experienced any stressful events. We asked them to self-report on their habits of ability to sleep and to the stress that they're experiencing in their daily lives. All of the questions that we ask, those particular scales are publicly available. The scales are used regularly. So if anyone's interested, they can look them up.
And Nathan,
yeah,
when we...
I would just, Sorry, I would just add to that that we use clinically relevant survey instruments for this study. We cite those in the paper. So as Teresa said, individuals could go out and look those instruments up to see exactly what the questions are.
And when we think about this, Nathan, what kind of support systems exist, if any, for PhD students to help them through these challenges? I know, obviously, you can't speak for all of graduate education, but I wonder at least what you all found in your research and your experience, Nathan?
Right. So one thing to point out is we didn't ask this question, actually, in our study in terms of what resources were available to the respondents. That is a very interesting question. But in terms of what is available to students, it really varies very widely from institution to institution. I can speak mostly about here at the University of Kentucky. We have counseling services that are available. Students, graduate students and postdoctoral fellows are eligible to go to those sessions, although it's limited in the number of sessions that they can attend in any given calendar year. And then the biggest issue, though, is that trainees, graduate students, postdocs, they don't know about these services. So they don't know that they are available to use. So that's a big problem.
I'm speaking with Nathan Vanderford. He's an assistant professor in the College of Medicine at the University of Kentucky, along with Teresa Evans. She teaches at University of Texas's Health Science Center in San Antonio. They were the authors, two of the authors of this study. We'll tweet that out if you would like to read more about that. And I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Inger Burnett Ziegler is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Northwestern University. Inger, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you work with students at Northwestern. I should add, when we're talking about stressful events, yesterday the Evanston campus was on lockdown after reports of a shooting at a graduate residence hall. I was involved with that. Half of our staff was, because we were here on the Evanston campus. It turned out to be a hoax, but I should ask, I don't know if you were on the Chicago campus, how you're doing and what you've been hearing from students.
So I am based on the Chicago campus, so I am a bit removed. However, I am doing okay. Thanks for asking. And most of the students that I work with are also removed. However, it did create quite a fury of fear and anxiety. The campus did a great job of keeping faculty, staff, and students notified. I got probably 8 calls from the university.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah, at least 8 calls and at least lots of emails every
emails
10 minutes.
And text.
They were very good about
exactly.
Stay in place. This is what's happening. Don't do
exactly.
anything.
Exactly, which yeah. is good to be informed, but also can create some additional anxiety about kind of what's going on and what's happening next.
Apart from that, and the unfortunate other stress that I think that we're adding to in terms of being on a campus and thinking about that, I wonder what you make of what you're hearing from Teresa and Nathan about the survey they did, just looking in particular at PhD students and how many of them indicated having moderate to severe depression.
Yeah, so I want to first thank Teresa and Nathan for the important work that they have done in bringing this topic to light. I was listening to the discussion earlier around the expectations that are placed upon graduate students and thinking about my own experience in a clinical psychology doctoral program and the experience of students that I work with. And in addition to the demands of the classes themselves, the demands associated with research productivity, clinical psychology students are also expected to engage in clinical work, in practicum. So their time is spread really thin in actual hours and expectations, and that can be quite challenging, particularly when you think about all of the actual things that they have to get done in the day, and then, you know, how one can kind of create a culture of balance within that. I'd also like to add, even though I am a research and clinical mentor to graduate students here at Northwestern, I also occasionally get some graduate students in my faculty practice that are bringing up some of these issues. They have sought out this help for the anxiety and depression that they may be experiencing that is the consequence to the stress that's coming up in their programs.
Teresa, I wonder if Nathan, if you can weigh in after Teresa. I wonder what other outside forces you're also seeing that are leading to more stress and anxiety, particularly within a graduate school setting. Inger was just mentioning, of course, the workload, which tends to be very intense and even more so when you're in a graduate program. What other outside forces are there? Teresa?
Yes, absolutely. So there are several. The first, in no particular order, but one to consider is even the stress and burden that's put on the mentorship team of these graduate trainees. And so that is in large part the faculty. And so there are papers that indicate that faculty in academic environments are increasingly burnt out and struggling with mental health issues as well. And so as we know, in work environments, when the leaders are experiencing these things, it's also an issue then within the team and the individuals that they're trying to lead. And additionally, graduate trainees are often in a period of their careers where they're balancing many things, not only in academic life, but also in their home life. And so work-life balance is a huge issue. And how do we integrate the requirements of our home life into the requirements of our academic training? And finally, something that our paper also investigated and is, you know, one of its kind to do so are the stresses that come from diversity, not only diversity in race and in culture, but also diversity in gender. And so these types of issues are all issues that the academic institution and culture really needs to start thinking about how to embrace.
Nathan, you all use this, you call this a crisis in graduate education. Why did you use that word?
Well, I think that Teresa and I and the other colleagues on the paper agree that anecdotally and from our data and other data that has similar work that's been done on this topic, I think we can all agree that these numbers are astronomically high, you know, particularly compared to the general population that's been measured on the same scales that we use. You know, as you said at the beginning, 6 times higher than the general population. And for people who are working in academia, you know, faculty and staff, we can see the stress and strain and anxiety and depression in our students. So we really truly do believe that this is a crisis, and it's only a matter of time until it more negatively impacts not only the students, but higher education as a whole.
Yeah, Inger, I was just going to end by asking you that. What do you think it means, not just for graduate education, but for higher education more generally, if PhD students, graduate students, aren't able to get the support that they need?
Well, I really think that this is raising attention to an issue and calling into question how we can create cultures where we develop students to reach their fullest potential in a way that they will remain healthy and productive at the same time. I think right now we're in a culture where objective measures of productivity are sometimes valued over the quality of the work, not only in graduate school, but also in other kind of high demand settings like corporate settings. And this is really a time for us to do internal analyses within individual graduate programs and think about, you know, the ways in which faculty, mentors, programs overall may be contributing to the depression and anxiety of students, and how we can kind of create a culture shift to make students help them to promote their own self-care.
That's Inger Burnett Zickler. She's a clinical psychologist. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavior Sciences at Northwestern University. I want to thank her, along with Teresa Evans at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and Nathan Vanderford with the University of Kentucky for being with us. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And that does it for us today. You can always find past shows, more information at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Grace Stetson and Fatima Farha are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in Evanston. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.